Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nimi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about true stories of a Vermont game warden with Megan Price, author of the book Vermont Wild. Vermont Wild shows the wackier side of being a game warden. It features retired warden Eric Noose of Johnson, Vermont, and his fellow wardens, and it also includes close encounters with gun-wielding poachers, love-struck moose, hungry bears, raucous raccoons, and the strangest use of dynamite you'll ever read. Eric Noose, who's the hero of these campfire tales, is well known to many Vermonters. He spent 32 years patrolling the woods and waters of the Northeast Kingdom and organizing outdoor education. He's currently the executive director of Orion, the Hunters Institute. Author Megan Price, who I'm talking to today, is an award-winning journalist who was also elected to serve three consecutive terms in the Vermont legislature in which she championed wildlife issues. As you'll hear, she first met Eric while attending Vermont's Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, and later organized and led the program for several years under Eric Noose's leadership. Megan is currently at work on Volume 2 of Vermont Wild, which is scheduled for release in the fall of 2011. When we spoke, I asked Megan how she first started writing Vermont Wild.
Vermont Wild was a process. I've always loved the outdoors. I was a journalist for many years, and I've worked in public relations and marketing, and I was a state legislator for three terms, and I've always been a writer. So I met Eric Noose as part of a nationwide program called Becoming an Outdoors Woman, and targeted for getting women into conservation issues, into the woods, supporting and understanding and having a deeper appreciation of habitat, the need for conservation and a balance in the wild world. So the state of Vermont adopted that program, and Eric was running it. I attended the program. There was an evaluation after the program, and of course, being a writer, I did extensive notes. And he came to me and he said, "Hey, that was quite an evaluation you wrote." I said, "Well, I had a great time, but, you know, you wanted suggestions for improvement." So I thought, well, okay. And he said, "Well, do you want to run it next year?" And I went, "Really?" Be careful what you're writing in an evaluation. So, but I just loved it. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was
What was the program? How long was it? What did you do?
It's a great program. It's nationwide. I encourage anyone to do this. It's designed for women age 16 and up, who maybe always wanted to understand the outdoors, be in the outdoors, learn survival skills, hunting, shooting, herbal medicine, anything you can think of outdoors. And there's a couple of basic premises behind it. One is that girls traditionally don't get the same opportunities as boys. They don't have people, men generally, to take them out and keep those survival skills and just appreciation of nature out in the woods that a boy would have traditionally. And I was one of those girls, you know, growing up in the 1960s, 70s, dating myself here, but it still continues, obviously. You're sitting around the table and you're hearing about all these adventures men are having out in the woods, and the girls are supposed to stay in the kitchen and cook and clean, and I hated that. I've always hated it. I still hate it. I want to be outdoors. And so I studied botany in college, but became a writer instead. And so this is designed for women of any age. I mean, we had women in their 80s coming to the program, and in a non-pressure environment, the instructors are all carefully evaluated and vetted. So there's, you know, whether they're men or women, they're just there to instruct. It's kind of like the difference of learning to drive a car from your parents or from, you know, an instructor. And there's just a huge emotional difference that takes place that you can deal with better if it's just somebody non-judgmental, you've got no history with them. Same concept. So it's inexpensive. Generally, you go for a weekend. You have different seminars, and I was responsible for setting up dozens of seminars, from canoeing, kayaking, sailing, fly fishing, finding the instructors, doing all the promotion, etc. And we'd have about 150 or more women for a weekend and all these instructors. and just a terrific time with no pressure. So finally you're sitting around a campfire with women who have the similar interests, similar insecurities about their skills in this area, and just laughing and having a good time. And my concern is, I didn't go the first year because I thought, oh, I'll just be clumsy and I'll be an idiot, and these women, it must be all Amazons. It must be like the triathlon of the outdoors. I'll just feel worse about myself than ever. You know, all those insecurities everybody, I think, really has. And the second year, I had a tall, skinny friend, and I'm short and fat, and I said, well, let's go together, because that way, if they're mean to us, like fifth-grade girls, we can sit in a corner and just talk among ourselves and sort of think evil thoughts. You know, like,
right.
Great. And we went, and everybody was in the same spot. I mean, everybody was insecure. Everybody was us. And we just had the best time. I mean, it's still one of the highlights of my life. So then I got to run it and be funny and yak with people and put everybody at ease and tell funny stories. So Eric, you know, he's a really great guy. He's got 32 years as a game warden. A great Jimmy Stewart kind of personality, laid back, nothing ruffles them, everything will resolve, everything's fine. And I'm really type A, over the top, let's get it done, even though I'm funny about it. So he came to me later. He always had campfire stories. And he came to me, so I've known about a decade, he came to me a few years ago and said, have you ever thought of writing a book about your adventures? Because I've had a lot of stupid things happen to me in the woods as I try to be the outdoors woman I want to be. And I said, well, I'm an English major. Everybody thinks about writing a book. What do you mean? And he said, well, you know, you've got really funny stories, and I've got funny stories. I thought we could put them together in a book. And I said, well, I don't know. It's a lot of work. Take it from a writer. It's a ton of work. So how it evolved was Eric is so busy. He's into all these different things, the Orion Institute, Fair Chase, all these other things. He's a forensic expert at trials for accidental or when guns go off and they shouldn't have them, somebody gets hurt or killed. So he has all kinds of different hats he wears and a second career as a retired game warden. And I said, look, just write down the titles that trigger memories for you and just tell me the stories. Just tell them to me. And so that's how it evolved. And eventually I said, you know, I've got funny stories too, but I think we've got enough to do a book of your stories. And it took like 3 years. I had a lot going on and tons of writing and some eye issues that made things really difficult working on a computer. But we got it done. And Eric, a friend who was Bob Lutz, who is also a retired game warden of 23 years experience, and a friend of Eric's, did the illustrations that just really frosting on the cake. And then Carrie Cook is a book designer. So I couldn't do it all myself. I tried being the independent, stubborn type, and it just was killing me to try to do everything, even though I'd done a lot of design work, et cetera. I could not do what I knew I wanted in my head. And so the book itself is designed for kids to read. I really see it as a way to get kids who hate school, sorry about that, academics, but don't like what they're being offered in school and want to be outdoors, to get them to read. And how that evolved was I went to one of the rare outings that I do, because I'm kind of a hermit. I went to a party and was talking to a woman who is in the Northeast Kingdom and is a school librarian. And I said, what do kids read? I mean, specifically, what do like fifth grade boys read? Because kids don't read anymore, right? And she just rolled her eyes and said, no, they don't. I said, well, what do they read? And she said, you know, the book that the boys check out is True Attacks of Grizzly Bears. I said, you're kidding. I'd read that too. I mean, I'd like go, oh, over the bad parts, but I'd read that. That would be something that I would read and go, oh my gosh, how to avoid that. So I told her, she said, what are you doing? And I told her, and she said, you know what? I think they might actually read that. You know, funny stuff, game warns, all true, outdoors, et cetera. And that changed the book for me, what I was doing. Any big words I was going to stick in the book, I knocked out. The biggest word in the book is extirpated, and I explained it in the book in a colloquial, funny way. So the kids didn't even have to look it up. I want it to be easy. I use big font because I read that it's not just the aging generation, I'm 50-something, that needs glasses to read the book, but I want it to be eye-friendly for everybody. And I read that children with reading disabilities and learning disabilities actually need big font, like adults with aging eyes, so they can, you know, close your eyes and think about the word and open your eye again and not get frustrated and lose their place on the page. So that's another reason there's a lot of white space, so they can see easier, comprehend, come back to the word. I did that for adults and for kids. It's a size that you can stuff in a backpack and take in the woods. And I had several hunters tell me last fall they stuck it in their backpack, went hunting, and sat on a stump and read the book. And I figured, well, that's good. I just had this image of a deer, you know, this, like, 10-point buck leaning over somebody's shoulder and laughing. Well, I actually want the illustrator to do a design like that of a guy sitting on a stump reading Vermont Wild and the deer going, oh, you know, like, that's really funny. I can't draw it, but I think Bob Lutz could. He's really good. And then Carrie Cook was a gift. She colorized the cover and made it come to life and made what was in my head work. So the book has been a big hit, quite honestly. I think it's going to get into L.L. Bean this summer. And I don't know what it's going to do there, but over the course of a few months, we sold a lot of books. And I haven't bothered to go nationwide. I haven't bothered to do any of that. I don't have the energy. And I'm kind of working on that slowly. But librarians, school teachers have told me they're reading it to their kids in class. The kids laugh, you know, they enjoy it, and they might actually pick up another book and put the video game down and or go outdoors. And the other benefit is that older people love it because it takes you away from your aches and pains or the fact that you can't go out in the woods anymore. People in hospitals have enjoyed it a lot. People going through chemo, any kind of dialysis where you can just, you love the outdoors, but you can't be there right now. You can read this book and laugh along with Eric's exploits and picture yourself in his shoes. They're all told in the first person like a campfire story.
Tell me about a bad day for Eric.
No, they're all kind of bad days. I think of a story. I mean, first of all, the book is really a tribute to game wardens. I mean, that's the way I saw it. I certainly could not do what they do. The danger factor is part of it. I guess you just have to put that out of your head. But generally, you're dealing with people who are armed, and you're alone in the woods, and you're pretty much always going to know that these people are armed. And if you're actually going after people who are poachers, of course, you know they're armed, unless they're fishermen. And I was actually told by a game warden, even the fishermen in Vermont tend to carry guns, a sidearm of some sort. I don't know why. They think they're going to get attacked by a shark in Vermont stream, but it's just, I guess, kind of a thing that you do. Maybe it's a way of just getting yourself out of the woods, doing an SOS if you need to. But Eric is generally, I think of these stories as Jack London sort of runs into Dave Barry perspective, and then they need some sort of MacGyver thing to get out of it. and it all has to be ingenious. I mean, he has to be clever and think on his feet. He has to be able to get himself out of these situations. And generally when you're dealing with wildlife and or people, but mostly wildlife, they're always going to do something that you did not expect. So, you know, there's raccoons getting loose in his car. He was going to move some orphan raccoons and resettle them in a new area, and they get loose in his car. And if anybody's ever dealt with any wild animal, they're remarkably strong and have all kinds of skills, and raccoons are really tricky. So that doesn't go well, as they say. And by the time he gets to, he never makes it to the release spot. He just pulls over. They've just torn the car apart.
Raccoons were in the car?
I can't remember, 6, 7, 8, something like that. They're just crawling all over. It's like spiders loose in the car.
I'm picturing one like on his head and another one driving.
Yeah, there's one in his head. They're crawling all over. You know, one sort of had a little biological accident on his head. And that slid down the back of his shirt. I mean, that really happened. And it was very uncomfortable. Because, you know, he's trying to drive. And
that's got
to
be a euphemism if I've ever heard one, you know,
Biological accident. Well, I'm sure the raccoon didn't plan it. Maybe he did. Raccoons have a good sense of humor. Maybe he did. But, you know, just tore his stuff up incredibly. But, you know, in the stories, I made sure everything turns out okay. I wanted to stay pretty lighthearted. I wanted the stories, and for the most part, that's true. Even if he's grabbing a poacher, he, at one point, he and, you know, there's other ones involved, but I stuck with Eric as the main character. They literally grabbed the barrel of a gun of this guy being quite intoxicated in his home and shooting out the window, and they jumped up and grabbed the barrel of the gun and pulled it, the rifle, and pulled this guy out the window. Now, that would never happen today. They would call, you know, they would call in a SWAT team, or they would call in something, and they, it would cost taxpayers, you know, $150,000 and put the guy away for weeks and court and this and that. They just took care of it. Everybody lived. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it did turn out okay. And that's the kind of ingenuity they had to use, and they did routinely to defuse situations. In terms of wildlife, in addition to raccoons, they actually had to corral a moose, and then they loaded it in basically a cattle hauling truck that was open in the top. They thought they had the thing drugged enough to get it to the Northeast Kingdom. This is when moose were pretty rare in the state, and they were trying to encourage a population. They had it tied, but it got loose, and it's sort of climbing up outside the truck, roaring through Island Pond, kicking and smashing and banging while they're trying to get it up to Island Pond to let it go. And you can imagine people looking at this thing as it's leaping out of the back of a truck, and they're trying to wrestle with it and keep it in there and nobody get hurt. Eric's trying to deal with poachers at the time. He's dealing with fish and moose. Another one is a bear story where he's called out to see what's destroying a farmer's corn crop. They think it's a bear. It's too much of a mess to be raccoons. Eric goes in the corn, and there's the bear is still in the corn. So that gets pretty exciting. And all of them, however, are told from the perspective of funny. Also, if you go into corn, that's why they create corn mazes, because you can't find your way out. So Eric's in the corn, and the bear's in the corn, and they're both listening for each other. They both know something is unusual in there, and they're both jumping up trying to see each other. And kind of like a Watusi warrior doing the dance, the bear does better because he's about 10 feet tall, and Eric's only like maybe a little under 6. And they're leaping and leaping and getting glimpses of each other and wondering how close the other one is. And there's a farmer on the hill who sort of describes what he saw. It's pretty funny. So all the stories, there's 13 stories, and they're all, I find a lot of people are also reading them to other people because, again, they're campfire stories, so they're fun to read out loud and read to people or read to kids. And it's just been good, and I'm trying to work on a second book. There's more good stories out there, and I think the book's going to be offered in Maine soon, and we'll move it around New England. So it's just been it's been heartening to have so many people really enjoy the book and get a lot of positive feedback about it. Part of it is that it's true Vermont history. These things happened, and also to recognize what game wardens do. I really feel they're the frontline environmentalists. I mean, they do really tough work, and they're out there in all weather, all seasons, and trying to make it a fair fight for animals, and I really admire and appreciate that. And to bring shine a light on the good work they do is, I just think it's really well-deserved, and I've been very heartened by the feedback there. The wardens also like the stories a lot.
In Vermont, what do game wardens do? You've mentioned fighting poaching. You've also mentioned accidental discharges of rifles and other weapons. Tell me, what is the range of things that Eric would do through his career? And has that changed over time?
Well, that's probably more of a question for Eric. But, he started out in the 1970s, I think, late 60s, early 70s. And they had more autonomy then. I mean, there wasn't, obviously, video surveillance and all these things that we have now in cell phones. They were self-directed. The job then was 24/7, and if you were called out, you went. So you would, there'd be a police dispatcher who would also dispatch wardens, but mostly it was surveillance and routine talking to people and finding out, just checking fishing licenses, hunting licenses. During deer season, they would be basically nonstop for weeks and weeks. And, of course, now deer season goes on forever in Vermont. It starts in, October and just keeps going. So we have more and more deer seasons. At that time, they'd also be reporting back to the biologist so people could make those folks who are planning, you know, herd management issues, fish stocking, et cetera, could report back and on their findings of what they saw in the woods and how stocking programs were influenced that way. But mostly it's checking licenses, making sure that, you know, that animals and the limits that's set by the state, which change from year to year, are followed. The taking of animals. And also, you know, encouraging, in terms of this moose, you know, there was such a small population of moose in the state that if they had one and it's off by itself, I mean, I learned from Eric that when the moose population was moving into Vermont, the young bull moose come first. And that's why we got the funny story that hit the public down in the Rutland area, and this is a similar story, of a moose latching on to a young bull moose just hanging out with a harem, his harem, of heifers. Bovines, you know, they're lonely. They're biologically, they're thinking, I need to be with somebody. I shouldn't be alone. They're a herd animal, and they're finding cows. And that's cute for a while until the rutting season, the breeding season starts, and it's really dangerous. They're pretty big. They get testosterone crazed, and they can kill you. And the farmer has to go get his cows two or three times a day and bring them in for milking. So it got dangerous, but they didn't want to kill the moose. They kept trying to drive it away. The farmer did. Finally, you know, they notify the game warden, and they decide to move it. So, and they did that, and it's extremely dangerous, obviously, to go get a moose. So first of all, they have to drug it, and nobody knows how much drugs a moose needs. You know, it's not a horse, and it's not a cow, and they're guessing. And they try, and it takes three or four darts to figure out to get the thing even calm, and then it won't go down because, like a horse, they can lock their knees, and it just stands there. And they literally had to go up and walk up to this thing and put a rope around its antlers and try to drag it into the truck. Well, that could get you killed. You know, they're really... but they did this, so they kind of risked their lives a lot. And I admire that. I wouldn't, you know, that's dangerous stuff. You could get hurt badly, very quickly. So it took a lot of risk to really enhance the populations of animals that we do have. There's a funny story that I haven't written yet about a turkey. And turkeys, we take for granted turkeys in Vermont, but they weren't here until, you know, the 1970s, and they brought in a few, I think a dozen or so from New York State that we borrowed. And now they're everywhere, but they were very new. And they literally had to sort of set up, I hope they find a girlfriend kind of situation.
So you know, it was like Match.com here.
right. Oh, we got a Tom, but there's a hen two towns over. How do we introduce them? You know, I mean, it was that kind of thing. They had to sort of facilitate these events, and if people saw one of these animals and it was rare, that could also cause an accident. So sometimes it's people management. It's often, I think, people management as much as wildlife management. And then educating people, you know, these were the days when they could pick up baby raccoons. Nobody can pick up baby raccoons in Vermont anymore. I mean, they're one of the main rabies vector species. So you can't and you shouldn't go touching any wild animals at this stage, any mammals, et cetera. This was before wildlife rehabilitators were in place. Now we have people who have special skills. There's just, you know, we've advanced a lot in some ways, but still the clash between humans and obviously wildlife are there.
So the story you were just telling about the young bull moose, that's with Jessica the...
Well, it wasn't Jessica the moose, it was another one. But yeah, it was Jessica and Bullwinkle, I guess they ended up calling it moose. That's a different story. This is a different situation that didn't get as much publicity. The Rutland Herald wasn't there. One of my former employers wasn't there at the time. it's a different moose situation, but a similar problem. Yes, the same problem. You've got a love-struck young bull moose that needs to be placed somewhere where he'll be safer. And in this instance, this is how they resolved it and tried to, and they moved the moose. Pretty darn tricky, actually. In another situation, they literally blow up a dead moose, which is hysterical, only in that, you know, if a moose dies, it's a big thing to desiccate, and it smells pretty bad, and you've got a lot of tourists coming. Sadly, wardens have to deal with a lot of roadkill and pretty gross stuff, and they have to deal with it, and the only way they could determine to move this moose was the carcass, was to dynamite it, which I guess would be good for the crows, make things easier, but that is a funny, crazy story where they canoe in, and Eric, they really have no clue of how much dynamite they should use, and he has 35 feet of fuse wire. I still can't believe they lived. 35 feet. Nobody in their right mind. I mean, if you watch that show on Discovery where they blow things up, they're always like behind plate glass and, you know, hiding behind armored vehicles, and they have on safety goggles and every other thing, and they make it a big deal for a little blast. These guys were out there in a canoe, Eric and a friend, with two sticks of dynamite and 35 feet of fuse wire, and they sort of created just this huge tidal wave, and they managed to make it out and take care of the problem, but it wasn't pretty. It just funny stuff, and all the locations in Vermont and the stories are true. So people, like this happened on Little Elmore Pond, and folks who know that area just really enjoy the stories. There's a fellow who I think is in his 90s who just... who also has his own good outdoor stories that I want to talk to. So people recognize the roads and the areas and where this poaching might have occurred, and the rivers that are mentioned are all true stuff. So that's part of the fun.
Has it gotten people to contact you with their stories?
Yeah, I met with a tax lady this weekend. It was funny. And she started telling me a story. It was really funny about a squirrel in the trunk. She just, and, you know, so what happens is one friend, what happens, young women are buying this book for men, which is what I find. Over the holidays, women buy the book for men, thinking this is a guy book. And then they hear these guys laughing, or they just peek into it, and they love it, which is fun. And a lot of folks who don't read will tell me, have come up to me and say, yeah, I read it all the way through. And I went, huh, to me, that's what you're supposed to do with a book, you know. And, and I just said, well, what did you like? And they just look at me like I'm stupid, which I am. And they said, I read it all the way through. And I realized in their world, that's a huge compliment, because most books bore the heck out of them. And the people try to give them books, and they're not reading it. It's not funny. It's too academic, it's too this, they're trying to, you know, they just don't want to read it. And these are all short stories that people who love the outdoors or appreciate nature, from kids from fourth or fifth grade through ancient, can read and appreciate and laugh. And I'm hoping it gives them an appreciation for wildlife, for habitat restoration and protection, for what game wardens do, and an understanding and appreciation of nature in general. That's kind of the underlying message. But that's what I find most heartening about the book, that it reaches every audience. And, you know, I've had people go, oh, well, so, you know, and they kind of like the hoity-toity type stuff, too. And then they pick it up, and they laugh a lot. They go, this is really funny. You know, it's kind of like people who don't want to go see Walt Disney stuff because, it's Walt Disney. It's not deep enough or painful enough or something enough. And then they read it and they go, that was really fun. Or they go see Secretariat and they realize, I really love that movie. That was a cool horse. You know, so I think I'm at a point. I wrote so much bad news during my life. And there's so many sad things going on in the world. You know, from Japan, we haven't dealt with Haiti yet. I mean, everything. And Wall Street is just like, it's overwhelming. And I call this part of my I Love Lucy solution. There's a point during the day or during your life or something, I just can't fix everything. I would like to be able to fix everything, and you can't. And this is something where you can appreciate nature. By the way, some of the proceeds are going to be given for wildlife habitat restoration as well as rehabilitation of animals. And so it's a way for you to escape, appreciate nature, do a little something, and honor game wardens and all they do all at once, and laugh. So I consider that a big win-win-win.
Yeah, and it's a different take, because a lot of books, there are other books out there by game wardens, memoirs, but it's not the funny, easy-to-read type of stories in this book. So this book is really
right.
Unique that way.
I've had game wardens tell me there's a lot of books out there, they're not very fun to read. And I went, well, this one is. You know, and they kind of go, no, it can't be. And then they come back to me and say, that's fun. That's fun. And I go, well, thank you.
In your opinion, what's the funniest story?
People ask me that. I like them all, actually. I mean, I work so hard at it. The funniest one.
Or I think a funny story that didn't make it in.
I thought the moose Vesuvius. I mean, even the titles are funny. You know, I've got like Fish and Tackle is Eric tackling somebody. So people think Fish and Tackle, she's writing about spoons and lures. But, you know, so there's a lot of it. It's kind of clever. It's as clever as I can get. Raccoon Riot, that's the raccoons. People love that one. Hunter Up, I really like the dog stories. It's crazy hunting dog who's just, you know, hopeless. But he actually finds a role and redeems himself. I love that. I think we can all identify that we just mess something up so bad, and then suddenly you pull that rabbit out of the hat and you're a hero. So I love that the dog does actually end up a hero. Bearware is the one I understand kids are rolling out of their seats in Orwell. As a teacher read it to them, that's the one of the bear and Eric jumping up back and forth in the corn. Squish in the Night is hysterical. It's about the cats getting into something in the middle of the night and Eric's first wife, who was so generous to let us even write the story. Thin Ice is Eric going through the ice, and he could have died all alone out there trying to stalk a pond, doing his job in the middle of winter so people would have fish to catch. The Two Loose Moose I mentioned to you. Moose Vesuvius is blowing up that moose. I thought that would be the best story and that would be the piece de resistance, but people actually love the Bearware, the one in the corn. They love the Raccoon Riot. Give Me the Gun is a more serious one. That's the one I talked about where they're, you know, grabbing that guy with the gun out the window and yanking. The guy held on to the rifle, by the way, and they both went flying out the window, the rifle and the man. This is crazy. He held on and went wing out the window. And Cover Me is Eric facing a couple of poachers all alone, and they're kind of aggressive, and he could have, you know, tables could be turned, and he could have been killed, and he faked having a partner up in the woods to help himself out.
I was about to ask, what was the scariest?
That was pretty scary, but you know, I've had a couple of, well, I'm talking to more game wardens now because I am trying to, working on volume two here. And one warden just said that he spent at one point like an hour and a half wrestling with three guys over guns. An hour and a half.
Wow.
And he just sort of downplayed that. I said, what? You know, I mean, before he could get backup from the state police, an hour and a half trying to protect himself from getting killed. You know, never made the headlines, never anything. And he just sort of downplayed that. He was telling me funny stories, which I appreciate. But I went, what? many of these guys, though they're retired, always carry a weapon with them and feel that they need to. You know, their lives have been threatened by people who are not happy that they were prosecuted. So at the same time, Bob Lutz, illustrator, told me that Vermont probably has the highest compliance rate, something we can be very proud of people who buy hunting and fishing licenses and comply with the laws and regulations. So in terms of compliance, we're probably at 94-95%. So for wardens in general, we're probably one of the safest states in the country. Last fall, a warden was actually killed in Pennsylvania over a deer. Shot by a poacher. Unbelievable. You know, it's unbelievable to me that somebody would do that. But it happens in other states. And we had a game warden die here in the 70s by someone who just lost it. And when the warden stopped him, the fellow reacted badly and killed him. So it happens.
Are there a lot of game wardens here in the state? We're a small state.
I think we're down into the 30s now. We're actually, the game wardens would tell you, understaffed right now. We're understaffed to what we used to have. And I'm not going to get into the politics of that. That's another discussion. But I understand that in terms of numbers we used to have, we don't have that many. And I don't know if technology makes it easier or what the thinking is behind that. But the numbers of game wardens are less than what we had 20 and 30 years ago.
As people retire, is it something that kids are going into, or is there also a drop-off because people aren't going into the field?
I think there's a lot of interest in wildlife protection, thanks to folks like you and your work, and Animal Planet, all those shows that I think there's a deep appreciation for the balance of nature and what needs to happen to keep what we have. But at the same time, you've got, you know, we all want to live in the woods, and it's easier to live in the woods. Excuse me. with the technology we have now and work from home, you know, what's the impact as we move out and move into the woods, and so it's all tricky. The population's growing. In terms of numbers of wardens in Vermont, though, the numbers are down. And I don't know, you know, with so many kids, I have nieces and nephews, and they just don't have the interest in the outdoors. I think it's, they'd rather be in front of a computer. They'd rather see nature on a screen. And that doesn't mean they don't appreciate it, I think. They love animals, they care about it, they understand, they watch Animal Planet constantly, et cetera. But the real hands-on stuff, I don't know if they could do or really have an interest in. So maybe more outdoor skills taught in an earlier age would be helpful.
And are you still involved in that, in the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program?
I got so busy that I couldn't do it. I did it for 3 years, and it was a great program, and they privatized it more. I had a contract that Eric awarded to me for 3 years to run it, manage it, do all the finances, et cetera. And so I got busy with my real job. I mean, I took all my vacation time and worked nights and weekends to put this together. I had another 60-hour-a-week job. But I loved it that much. It was that important to me that I did it. So then I got even busier. and Eric was retiring. And I said, but, you know, it's time. Let's let somebody else do it. So it's now run by a good organization called Vermont Outdoor Guide Association, VOGA. And they run something they call Doe Camp. And I've just been too busy to work with it. But people, women can find it there, VOGA.org, I believe is the website. And they can find Doe Camp, and they have different opportunities year-round for getting outdoors, whether it's kayaking, canoeing, shooting sports, archery, fly fishing, et cetera, et cetera.
And you said it's also affiliated with a national program focused
on... There's a woman named Peggy Farrell started this out of Wisconsin, and you can also go anywhere around the country. You can go to Africa. You can go all over the place with the Outdoor Women program. You don't have to just do Vermont. If you Google up Becoming an Outdoor Woman, you'll find these programs and opportunities. And again, it's all ages and no pressure, and just have fun. Pick what you want to do and do it. Just
sounds
really, really fun.
And it sounds great for people who are into it already or have never done it.
But yeah, you can do it to the best of your skill level. I mean, you can, and then, you know, you hook up with other people who have the same interests, and the idea is afterwards you say, gosh, that was so much fun. I'll meet you, you know, Tuesday next month, let's go out kayaking and canoeing together. Let's go fly fishing on the stream. Let's whatever. You know, we had some great fly tires. I really love that. That's fun. So just wonderful opportunities to do anything you can think of. If you can think of it in the outdoors, they would kind of work with you to find somebody to help teach you that.
Now, as a reporter, what have been some of the outdoor stories? You started this by talking about how originally the idea was that you and Eric would both tell your stories, and your book has focused just on Eric's stories, but what about your stories? Are you thinking of putting them in a book? And what are, you know, what's one of your funniest stories?
Oh, I've
yourself?
I've got crazy turkey hunting stories where I was attacked by turkeys.
Oh, you're attacked by turkeys?
Yes, I've been attacked by turkeys before. And somebody said, I had to go to the dentist later that day, so I went, and I was attacked by a turkey. Anyway, it flew at my head and scared the heck out of me, and I had the gun, and I swung the gun at it like it was a broom, trying to, like, oh, my God. And they're very large, by the way. You know, a turkey comes at you, they look like when they open their wings and fly at your head. And
it flew at your head.
I went later to my dentist, who was a pretty avid hunter, and he said, well, why didn't you just pull the trigger? And I said, I never thought of that.
Why? I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. Why didn't you what?
Why didn't you pull the trigger? Like, you got a loaded shotgun, and here's this turkey, and it's flying at you. Why didn't you pull the trigger and kill it? And I had never thought of that. I said, what? You know, like, no, I mean, in my head, they're just supposed to put their head up, like the Alvin York movie, you know, Sergeant York, and you're just supposed to go, boom, which I don't know if I can really shoot anything anyway. I sort of just carry the gun as a joke. Like, I carry the gun, I take it for, it's like taking the gun for a walk is the one, once a year you take it out of the cabinet, you put some shells in your pocket, and you go for a walk. And then if you fall and break your leg, then you can take the shells out and put them in the gun and shoot the gun as an SOS. That's basically my reason for taking the gun. But I just like to be out in nature and take pictures and whatever. But I do hunt and shoot, and I'm pretty good shot, and pretty good fisherman, and I just love to be outdoors, and all these things, kind of like Eric, all these things that shouldn't happen, happen. You know, like, just crazy stuff. I've had a number of boats, and I can't swim at all. So that's kind of interesting. That's always been fun. And it's just a way to get out in the woods. I've had bulldozers. I've cut my own trees. I've camped around Europe. I mean, I've done all these crazy things. And survived. I rented a cabin out in the Olympia Forest there, below Seattle, below Olympia, Washington, and it had, the only thing I had was electricity. I didn't have a bathroom or running water or anything, and I was putting myself through college and like living out there, and at night, the attic would just be alive with these creatures, and I would had a mattress on the floor, and there was a hole in the door, so the slugs, those 6-inch slugs would sometimes come in, but I would just take my broom and bang on the ceiling to get them to shut up so I could sleep. You know, now most people would not live the way I lived, but I knew they weren't going to hurt me, whatever they were. And, you know, I just sort of muddle along. I used to cook on a campfire because I couldn't cook any other food. And in Washington State, that's pretty tough because nothing will burn because it rains all the time. So, so all kinds of, you know, like stupid, funny things that I've done to get by. And when I wrote in the story about, the dead moose story, I mean, I spent last summer trying to get a mouse out of my car. The mice were living in my car, so I had traps set in the back of my car, and I did catch some. I mean, most people wouldn't put up with that, you know, mice losing their car. And I left the window down so the cat would only sleep in my car, but she wouldn't let go catch them, which is probably kind of hard for her to get around. But finally I did catch a mouse or two in the back.
And did it make a difference, or more just came, you know, I mean?
Oh, well, no. Finally I found out that I just couldn't live. You know, I said, I'm going to get hantavirus or something really bad here. I'm going to die. So I pulled out the vents, and I opened up the air cleaner, and I found, not only were there mice in the car, but I found a huge nest of half-chewed acorns in my air filter. And so I scooped them all out, and I went and bought some wire and put it over the air intake. Now, most people would take your car to the car dealer, but I just try to do it myself. I'm not going to pay somebody $300 or $400 to do what I could do, or I should do, or what shouldn't have happened to begin with. So in that way, I think I'm a pretty self-reliant kind of Vermonter who gets into these stupid situations. And it probably means I should drive more, but I refuse to do that. So, and I'm amazed that probably the mouse went around quite a while.
Well, maybe they just wanted to travel, you know?
Yeah, I know. So, so I duct tape all the vents on my car. That was the only way I could live last summer. Because, I shouldn't even tell you this, but these are the things I'm doing all the time. People go, you do what? And I go, just get along, you know what I mean? I'm trying to have a very small impact on the planet here and not cause a lot of trouble and not go spend a lot of money and just get along. I've done a lot of things. I cut trees and I did all that, and I had a bulldozer and
And what did you do with your bulldozer?
I tried to actually clear some spots for habitat for wildlife on my land, and it was, some of it was successful and some of it wasn't. I was in a hammock. That was one turkey attack I had, but another turkey attack I had, I was lying in a hammock, because I put a hammock up on this acreage that I have, and I was calling turkeys, and they started to answer back. It was about 2 days before turkey season. I wanted, you're supposed to scout out the area. And I'm just taking a book into the woods and a peanut butter jelly sandwich lying in the hammock. But anyway, I'm just, you know, watching wildlife, and I'm lying there, and I'm doing the turkey call thing. And all of a sudden, I hear turkeys make a lot of noise. They kick up leaves, and they sound like there's an army coming. And I realize, oh, my gosh, they're actually coming. So, And this isn't my best turkey call. I'm just making a little noise here. And I shut up, and they keep coming. And I'm surrounded by turkeys in the hammock. I'm not kidding. And all of a sudden, I'm pretty low in the hammock, and they're as tall as I am, and they're looking at me, like, in the eye. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, I'm surrounded by these turkeys. I don't have a gun. I haven't got anything. And I just stay there like a, sort of like a caterpillar in a cocoon going, oh, this is scary. And it's one of those net ones, you know, open air hammock. And I'm lying there, and they walk past me, and one pecks me in the back of the head. I felt a little sniff and then a peck. They were trying to figure out what I was. I was fairly well camouflaged because it was a picnic table and then the hammock, but they hadn't, and they must have gone through there quite a bit, but they hadn't seen, you know, the caterpillar in the cocoon before. And I actually got pecked in the back of the head by the turkeys. Now I come back there 2 days later, before the crack of dawn, with a shotgun, with everything, with the camo, all set to go. They're nowhere. But, you know, 2 days earlier, they got me. So it's kind of like playing tag with them. This is the sort of stuff that happens to me all the time. Really, all the time. It's like, I can't believe that happened. What is that? So, you know, that's kind of like funny stuff for a story.
And how about moose? Idiot. Do you have your own moose stories as well?
No, I'm not much of a, I mean, no. Lots of horror stories. Moose stories, no. We had a, when I was a kid, my father used to, before there were wildlife rehabilitators, we used to end up with them. So that I grew up with a fox. And we did get him a rabies shot, by the way. And he was very sweet. We actually rehabilitated him and let him loose, and he was fine. And I just must say that red foxes are wonderful animals, or this one was. He was really sweet, and he was a combination of a dog and a cat, and the way he behaved. He just loved having his belly rubbed. He smelled really bad, I must say, because they're musky kind of guys, but just beautiful and friendly and like a little dog and kind of a little yip. And, you know, we eventually, my father got him so he, you know, he'd pick up rabbits that had been killed by the side of the road, and we let him go. And he made it for a couple of years. We made sure the neighbors knew, you know, it wasn't a rabbit fox or whatever. And he made it.
Hmm.
So that was nice. So my family was kind of into this stuff. My dad was a hunter most of his life, and I got out in the woods early. I think that made a big difference. You know, from the age of 3 or 4, it was go out in the woods.
So what's next for you? You said you're writing another...
Well, there's volume two. There's volume two. And there's volume two, and there might be 3 and 4, actually. There's volume two, and then there's hopefully a Maine Wild. You know, there's 50 states out there, there's Canada, there's a lot of potential here. There's a lot of good stories, and I don't know if I have the time or energy or skill, but I think these guys deserve a lot of credit. I think television sometimes, well, they've got to have the drama, and they, you know, they jump in, and I've watched some of this. There seems to be a lot of recognition coming to Game Wardens right now. I've seen some shows, I don't get all the channels, but a lot of it's kind of too gory for me. I want things that, well, here's one of the things of the Outdoor Women program that was important. Women still outlive men, and so women inherit the land, much of the land. And so women may not have the expertise, knowledge, or know what to do with it. You know, like, okay, I've got all this land. George is dead. I've got all this land. How do I manage it properly? What do I do? You know, and it's a huge learning curve to figure all that out. Part of becoming an Outdoor Woman program, it taps into that, you know, habitat's important. How do we protect it? What animals live here? What could live here? What used to live here? What's the proper ratio and balance? Should you sell? Should you protect? Should you have covenants, et cetera, et cetera? That's a little piece of that. It's something to open people's eyes. And if you're, that's part of the value in becoming an Outdoors Woman program, and even on a book like this that says, oh, look, those animals need a place to live. Let me think about that. This is just a fun introduction to all those issues out there that overwhelm me at this stage of my life. that I can only stick with the I Love Lucy solution, back to that, which is keep it light and fluffy at some point. It's overwhelming. Everything is doom and gloom. We're losing the planet. The animals are dying. It's all your fault. There's too many humans. And I just can't deal with that anymore. There's a point where I can only do so much. I can't fix everything. You know, I can't fix everything. But maybe I can help the next generation who's got some more energy or wants to do it, or who together we can fix something. You know, start little, Voltaire, start with your own backyard. This is my little contribution. It's just fun, it makes people laugh, it helps people who are ill escape. And that was the other part of it. A friend, and I've had a number of people say this, for people who are older, who can't get out in the woods anymore, they're not well, whatever, but who have their own adventures. I have a friend who said, you know, her dad never talks, but at Thanksgiving they couldn't shut him up. He had read this book, and he was just, like, excited, and he was just telling all these stories, and also his own stories, and they had never heard Dad talk that much. And they've had 50 years of Thanksgiving with this man, you know, and all of a sudden he was alive and excited and telling all his stories and talking about this book, and I consider that a real gift, you know, to give to somebody to say that family got closer together and they met their father that day. They met the dad when he was 20, and they weren't even a twinkle in his eye that day because he was reliving his adventures. That's a wonderful thing.
That's a great way to end this interview. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me, Megan.
Well, thank you, Laurel, for the invitation, and thank you for what you do. Together, maybe we'll make a difference.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, God bless. Thank you, Laurel.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about strange stories of a Vermont game warden with Megan Price, author of Vermont Wild.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the Animal Wise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.